This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
So we're here at the Parkes Observatory in New South Wales, Australia, and joining us today is John Sarkissian, the operations scientist of the Parkes Telescope, the 64-metre dish.
Good morning, Neil. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thanks. Right then, so could you first of all tell us a little bit about yourself, your position as operations scientist and what that means?
That's right. Well, I'm an operations scientist here at the CSIRO Parkes Radio Observatory, and my main responsibilities are the operation systems development at the radio telescope and the support of visiting astronomers with their observations. In addition, I'm also involved in pulsar research, which is an exciting field of radio astronomy, as you know.
Definitely.
And I'm also involved in numerous outreach and public relations activities for the CSIRO Australia Telescope National Facility.
So how long have you actually been at Parkes then?
Okay, well, this October will be 13 years. I originally came here in 1996 to work on the Galileo mission to Jupiter. Parkes Observatory was contracted by NASA JPL to track the spacecraft for 10 hours every day for 1 year. They needed operators to do all that, and so I came along and seized the opportunity to do a lot more things, and I've really enjoyed my time here. It's been absolutely fantastic. It's a wonderful place to work, and these last 13 years have been just wonderful.
That's good to know. Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about the telescope, how it was built, and who built it, please?
Well, the Parkes telescope this October will be commemorating 48 years of operation. It was commissioned back on the 31st of October 1961, and it was designed to CSIRO specifications by a British firm, Freeman Fox and Partners of the UK. In fact, it's the same company that designed and built the Sydney Harbour Bridge. They've got an illustrious record in Australia of building iconic engineering structures. But the main contractors for the telescope were MAN of Germany and Ascania, who built the master equatorial system that helps point the telescope very accurately. And during the design phase of the telescope, Freeman Fox and Partners actually contracted a famous engineer by the name of Barnes Wallace, who contributed a few very innovative design features that have allowed the telescope to remain at the forefront of world radio astronomy ever since. For example, it was Barnes Wallace's idea to build it like an inverted umbrella pivoted in the center. Other telescopes at the time, large dish antennas, were being pivoted on the edges, like the Jodrell Bank dish, for example. Barnes Wallace thought, you know, perhaps a better way to do it would be to mount it from the center, like an umbrella. And it's worked wonderfully. And the design, many of his design features were incorporated in all subsequent large single dish antennas. Which is why I guess the Parkes telescope looks like the archetypal radio telescope, because it was so successful, people end up copying the design. Perhaps the most famous example of that was that JPL in the early 1960s actually used the Parkes telescope as the model for the large antennas in their deep space network. And so whenever people visit nowadays, they always think it's a satellite tracking antenna, and we have to always correct them, say, no, we're a radio telescope and so on. But at the time, it was designed as a survey instrument, and it was only intended to have a lifetime of about 20 years or so. So we well and truly exceeded that. Mm. And perhaps the main reason why we have exceeded that design lifetime of 20 years is because the telescope itself was built so well. It was much stronger than it really needed to have been. And it's meant that over the years we've been able to upgrade the telescope and make it more efficient and more reliable. For example, over the years we've replaced the inner 55 meters of steel wire mesh panels with perforated aluminium panels. And that's allowed the telescope to be more sensitive at the higher frequencies. And so we've been able to do research and observations that it wasn't originally optimized for. Also, in 1995, we replaced the focus cabin with a new larger one, which is double the size and weight of the old one. And that's meant that we're able to install several receivers in the focus cabin. And just by pressing a button in the control room, we can move any one of those receivers onto the focus within a very short time, within just a minute or so. And that's made the telescope a much more frequency agile and more efficient instrument. In the past, if you wanted to change receivers and observe at a different frequency, The entire process would take more than a day to do, because you had to disassemble the receiver that was installed and then bring that down in pieces, and then take the new receiver up again in pieces and reassemble it all in the focus cabin. And it was very time consuming and not very efficient way of changing receivers. But with this new focus cabin, it's made the process a lot easier for us. And in fact, most of the upgrades to the telescope, at least on the hardware side, in terms of the dish surface and so on, have been either completely or partially funded by NASA. Because each time NASA comes to us to support a space mission or so, we usually end up getting a better telescope out of it. We for example, the monies we received from tracking Apollo 11, we put into upgrading the dish service in 1970. And more recently, in 2003, we were asked by NASA to support their Mars missions. There was a traffic jam of spacecraft at Mars that year in 2003. And so we extended the paneling out to 55 meters. In 1995, in order to support the Galileo mission, they built us the new focus cabin, because they only needed us for 10 hours every day for 1 year. So what were we to do with the remaining 14 hours, you know? So NASA thought it was a good idea to build us a new focus cabin so that we could switch receivers very quickly. So once a Galileo track was over, we'd put our radio astronomy receiver on focusing and observe for the 14 hours. And then the following day, we'd switch back very quickly to the Galileo receiver and track the spacecraft for them, and so on. We've had a really great relationship with NASA over the years. So each time they come to us, almost, we get a better telescope with new receivers and upgrade. And the reason they have come to us is because the telescope itself is a near-ideal instrument for tracking spacecraft in deep space. Mm-hmm. But it's only a small portion of what we do here. It represents about, well, perhaps less than 1% of the work we do. But it's invariably the most famous things we do. And so the public have it in their mind that that's all we do. And so, but we are first and foremost the radio astronomy observatory.
So you could just talk us through the significance of building the site at Parkes.
Edward Taffy Bowen, who was the chief of the CSIRO's radiophysics division in the 1950s, decided that in order to further the pioneering research into radio astronomy done in the immediate post-war years, he concluded that the next instrument that the CSIRO should build was a large, fully steerable dish antenna. And that eventually became the 64-meter antenna here, the dish here. And they needed a place to put it somewhere, because it was going to be such a large instrument. They really needed somewhere pretty remote from large population centers that could potentially produce a lot of radio frequency interference, or RFI as we call it. And so they searched around the state of New South Wales looking for an appropriate site to build the telescope. They needed it to be within at least four or five hours drive of Sydney, so that technicians at their headquarters in Sydney could come out during the day, do some work, and conceivably even return later on, all in one day. Eventually, they chose the Parkes region in central New South Wales, which is about 300 or 400 kilometres almost due west of Sydney. Because just to the east of the site is a little mountain range. Well, they're lofty peaks by Australian standards, but there's little foothills more. But they protect the site from the large population centres further east, such as Sydney and Orange and Bathurst and so on. And the town of Parkes is about 20 kilometres south of the site, behind some low hills. And so the area was actually very radio quiet in the 1950s. There was a farmer by the name of Australia Helms, or better known as Ostie to his friends, who was thinking of selling part of his property. And so the CSIRO looked it over and decided it was an appropriate site. So they built the telescope here. The other great advantage, of course, is that from these latitudes in Australia, the center of the Milky Way passes directly overhead. And so you're able to see the richest and most interesting parts of the Milky Way from this latitude in Australia. And because we're in a relatively remote part of New South Wales also, it was a very radio quiet site. So it was an ideal place to build it. The valley that we're in is called the Gubang Valley. And another reason was the climatic conditions here were such that the winds weren't as severe as perhaps some other alternate places that they had looked at. And so although the last few weeks, as you know, Neil, the wind's been pretty high. So we're not immune from high winds, but at least for a large part of the year, the winds are quite low. And so if you're building a large inverted umbrella like the Parkes telescope is, you don't want to have a region that has very high winds, because just like an umbrella, when the wind blows, it wants to try and do things to the antenna that it's not, that we don't want it to do. The wind loading is severe, and so we usually have to park the telescope in the stow position, which is pointing up. And nowadays, you know, we probably lose around 3% of time because of that.
You mentioned the Apollo 11 mission earlier. So could you just walk us through what role Parkes played in this mission?
I mentioned that the Parkes was the model for the large antennas of the Deep Space Network. So in the 1960s, NASA began to build those. In 1966, they built the first antenna at Goldstone. But because of the budget cutbacks, they weren't able to build the other 64-metre antennas at Tidbinbilla and near Canberra and Madrid until the early 1970s. And so when the Apollo 11 mission was coming up in 1969, NASA were quite keen to have another large antenna tracking it in addition to the big Goldstone dish and the smaller array of 26-metre antennas at Honeysuckle Creek, again near Canberra and elsewhere around the globe. And so in October of 68, when John Bolton, who was the legendary first director of the Parkes Observatory, was visiting Caltech to see some colleagues, he was invited to a dinner party one evening at the home of Bob Leeton, who was a brilliant Caltech engineer. And in fact, many of the listeners, he may be more familiar as the Leeton in Feynman Lectures series of textbooks. But anyway, during the course of the dinner, John Bolton was asked if he could make the Parkes telescope available for the upcoming Apollo 11 mission. Because it was the first manned lunar landing mission, there were a lot of unknowns. NASA really didn't know what to expect. They weren't sure what the signal strength from the transmitters on the lunar module would be like. So they were very keen to have the largest and most sensitive radio telescopes pointing at the lunar module to be receiving those signals at those critical moments, especially when it was on the lunar surface. And so because human lives were at stake and because of the historic nature of the mission, John Bolton and Taffy Bowen agreed to support the mission. And so in the months leading up to the mission, there was a lot of work going on here to support it. And because it was in July, the weather was the last thing they had on their mind, because the weather in July in Australia is very cold and it's winter here. But winter is the least windy part of the year. They didn't think there'd be any problems with wind on that day. Unfortunately, Mother Nature had other ideas, and so on the day of the moonwalk, the astronauts had landed about 6:17 a.m. in the morning, Australian Eastern Standard Time. And that was about 7 hours before the moon was yet to rise at Parkes. And so while they were preparing for the moon to rise, a violent squall hit the telescope, literally just minutes before the moonwalk was to begin. The dish was fully tipped over, waiting for the moon to rise, when this violent squall hit, and in fact it was struck by gusts of over 110 kilometres an hour, which forced the dish and slammed it back against its zenith axis pinions and caused the tower to shudder and sway. John Bolton held his nerve and told his men to stay on it, and just as Buzz Aldrin switched on the TV camera, the moon moved into the field of view of the Parkes telescope. And along with the antennas at Honeysuckle Creek near Canberra and the giant Goldstone dish in California, we received the signal simultaneously, relayed them to Houston. Because the Parkes telescope was the prime receiving antenna, intended to be the prime receiving antenna for the moonwalk, everything was configured for Parkes to be receiving those. And so all the equipment, the relays, everything was optimized for Parkes. And so it was no surprise that the best TV pictures received came through Parkes. And so Houston, within a few minutes of the broadcast beginning, switched to Parkes and remained with Parkes for the remainder of the moonwalk. Luckily, the winds abated slightly, but throughout almost the entire course of the EVA, the winds were well above what we normally observe through.
EVA stands for extravehicular activity.
That's right, yeah, the moonwalk. So throughout almost the entire moonwalk, the winds were well above our normal safe operating speeds. And so the world at large were watching the TV and seeing those ghostly pictures of Armstrong and Aldrin on the moon, had no inkling about what the drama that was unfolding here at Parkes. But luckily, everything worked brilliantly. And it was such a dramatic moment, especially at the beginning, that it inspired, about 30 years later, it inspired the Working Dog production company in Melbourne here to produce a film on it called The Dish. Just inquire at your local video store, and I'm sure you'll get it. It's a fantastic film.
It actually is really good. So you mentioned a little bit earlier about the science at Parkes. Could you briefly go into the capabilities of the telescopes?
Okay, as I said, when the telescope was built back in the early 60s, it was intended to be a survey instrument. At the very beginning, Taffy Bowen and John Bolton understood that for the telescope to make an impact, they really needed to get great results very early. And within months of the telescope being commissioned, they struck gold, if you like. In August of 62, the Parkes Observatory was instrumental in discovering the true nature of what we now refer to as quasars, which are the most distantly known objects in the universe.
So these are radio galaxies several million light years away.
And in fact, the area of emission is very small, but because they're so far away, the amount of energy being emitted by them is incredible. You can detect it clear across the universe. Even with relatively small instruments, you can detect some of the brighter ones. They're just so energetic. Now, they were very enigmatic. No one really knew what they were. And part of the problem was they weren't sure in an optical photographic plates which objects they were. You know, in the field of the radio beam, there were innumerable stars. So which one of those was the emitter? It wasn't really all that well known. And so in August of 1962, it was realized that the moon was going to pass in front of one of the brighter one of these called 3C273. It was the 273rd object in the third catalogue of radio sources compiled by the Cambridge Radio Astronomy Group. And Cyril Hazard, who was an astronomer at Sydney University, realized that if you could time the disappearance of the signal as the moon moved in front of it and then when it reappeared on the other side, because they could calculate the edge of the moon very, very precisely, they could determine exactly where that object was. And so John Bolton got involved with the Parkes telescope and they observed the source. And in fact, it was going to occur right on the telescope's horizon. And so just to be sure, John Bolton cut pieces off the dish so he could tip it even further and dug a trench around it to get it even further still. And they made the observation and determine the position, and they then sent that information to Martin Schmidt, who was working at the Mount Palomar 200-inch telescope in California. He observed it and took a spectra of it, and it took another couple of years until he realized that what he was observing were the spectral lines of an object that was incredibly redshifted, indicating that it was very, very distant. And so that began an entirely new line of research. Other areas of research here that we've done is pulsars. Soon after pulsars were discovered by Anthony Hewish and Jocelyn Bell in 1967, just a week or so after the paper was published in Nature, astronomers here observed the pulsar and then immediately started looking for more. And so ever since then, the telescope now has discovered more pulsars than all the other telescopes in the world combined. One reason for that is because of our ideal location in the world. Pulsars are normally found within the galactic plane, in the Milky Way. And so if you've got the center of the Milky Way with the richest and most interesting parts visible directly overhead, then you're going to be discovering an incredible number of pulsars. So that's been a major area of research. And just to give you a flavor of some of the things that we've discovered just in the last few years, in 2003, during the High Galactic Pulsar Survey, the double pulsar was discovered here. That's two pulsars orbiting about each other. That's been a great system to be studying in great detail because it allows you to study the magnetospheres of the pulsars for the very first time in detail, because the beam of the pulsars have to pass through the magnetosphere of the companion pulsar. And so we're able to probe the magnetospheres of pulsars in great detail for the first time. We're also able to use it to do really stringent tests of general relativity. One example that I like to quote is that the two pulsars are about 800,000 kilometers apart, you know, in their orbit, which is about twice the Earth-Moon distance. But they take only 2.4 hours to orbit each other. So it's a very relativistic system. Yeah. And general relativity predicts that in such a strong gravitational field like that, gravitational waves must be radiated, taking energy out of the system. That should result in the orbit of the pulsar shrinking by 7 millimeters a year. And in fact, we've done the observations again with astronomers from Jodrell Bank Observatory and in Italy and our colleagues here. And we found that, yes, indeed, it is shrinking by 7 millimeters there, which is an incredible achievement. It just shows just the level of precision that we can observe these really fascinating objects. In 2006, we also detected the first radio magnetar. Magnetars are believed to be similar to pulsars, but only even more magnetized, you know, 1,000 times more magnetic than normal pulsars. They're still little understood objects. Most of the magnetars have been discovered in the X-ray and gamma ray regime. Of the two known magnetars, which were discovered in 2006 and 2007, both were found here at the Parkes Telescope. Mm. That's one area that I've been involved in, to regularly observe the magnetars and try and understand how they work with my colleague Fernando Camillo, who's the principal investigator for that project.
So what frequencies can you observe with the Parkes Telescope?
Well, the Parkes Telescope can theoretically observe from as low as, say, 75 megahertz all the way up to maybe 115 gigahertz frequency. However, because of various constraints such as RFI and the surface accuracy and so on, our receivers currently operate from about 600 megahertz up to about 22 gigahertz. That's quite a large range of frequencies for a radio telescope to be operating at. And we're able to do that because of all the upgrades we've done on the surface over the years. And it's one reason why the telescope is such a productive instrument, because astronomers can observe over such a large range of frequencies. It just makes the research here more efficient and productive. Now, one receiver that has really revitalized the observatory is what we refer to as the 20-centimeter multi-beam receiver. Conventional type receivers essentially look at a single point in the sky at any one time. They would sit on the focus and it would concentrate the radio waves, convert them to electrical impulses, send the signals down for amplification and digitization and processing and so on. But in the early 1990s, it was realized that you can actually do a bit more than that. And if you could build we call a multi-beam system, which is several receivers in one, just all clustered together at the focus, then you could look at several points simultaneously on the sky. And so the CSIRO set about to build the 20-centimeter multi-beam system, which had 13 receivers in one. And that's meant that when the receiver was built and put in place, that you could look at 13 points simultaneously in the sky. And it was equivalent to having 13 Parkes radio telescopes all sitting side by side scanning the sky. And it's fantastic. For a fraction of the price, you get 12 extra telescopes, essentially. And so because the telescope is essentially a survey instrument, surveys which in the past would have taken perhaps 30, 40 years to complete could be completed in just 3 or 4 years. Using this multi-beam system, because you can, as a telescope scanning across the sky, it looks at 13 points simultaneously rather than a single point. And so suddenly a lot of surveys that hitherto had been difficult to even get going, because no one's going to spend 30 years of their career doing one survey and so on, suddenly became feasible. And so we built the receiver, and it's been a fantastic instrument here. For example, we began with what we call the high-pass survey, the H1 Parkes All-Sky Survey, which was where we scanned the entire sky visible from Parkes at the 21-centimeter hydrogen line. The data we collected was incredible, but it's allowed astronomers to map the distribution of galaxies out to about 300 million light years or so. A related survey to that was what we call the Zone of Avoidance Survey. The zone of avoidance is the central part of the galactic plane, the Milky Way essentially, where in optical wavelengths, the light is blocked by all the dust and gas that lies in the Milky Way, and so you can't see what lies beyond that. And so that's been referred to as the zone of avoidance, because the galaxies and things that lie beyond them don't seem to be there, because the light just doesn't get through. But in radio wavelengths, the signal gets right through, unattenuated almost. And so you're able to, if you could survey the galactic plane, you can see what lies beyond for the first time. And that was completed within a couple of years. And the result is that there's pretty much the same there as there is elsewhere in the universe. So, but at least we've filled in some of the detail now. So that's been really great. And of course, we began the Pulsar survey, the Parkes multi-beam Pulsar survey. In 1997, an analog filter bank, which was designed and built at Jodrell Bank Observatory, installed here. And we scanned the entire galactic plane, the Milky Way, that is visible from Parkes. And in the space of, I think it was 4 years, we discovered over 700 pulsars in that survey. We more than doubled the previously known number. And of the pulsars known before the survey, about half were found at Parkes also. So it's been an incredible survey, absolutely phenomenal, the results, and the it's just fantastic survey. And all thanks to the multi-beam receiver. And the reason that we were able to build the multi is quite interesting, because it was all due to the Galileo probe. Shortly after it was launched and sent on its way to Jupiter, the antenna, which was built like an umbrella and which was supposed to be unfurled again like an umbrella once it was in space, failed to unfurl. And so this thing was stuck, and NASA thought, oh my goodness, you know, we're going to lose all the data. $1 billion mission. Fortunately, it took 7 years to get to Jupiter. They had time to think up a solution, and their solution was to link all the large antennas in their deep space network along with Parkes, so that the combined signal strength could be boosted and they could recover some the information that was being transmitted. If the antenna had unfurled properly, the data rate would have been about 139,000 bits per second from the spacecraft. With the antenna in its stuck position, it was down to 10 bits per second. But by linking the various antennas together, for those few hours that they were all linked together and viewing the spacecraft, the bit rate could be raised to 160 bits per second. Still well down on 139,000 bits per second, but better than 10. And then by using clever data compression algorithms and so on, they were able to recover 70% of the planned science and salvaged it from total disaster. But for us to support, we needed a bigger focus cabin, as I mentioned before, so that we could have more than one receiver up there. And by building that larger focus cabin, it meant we could actually build the multi-beam receiver and put it in the focus. Because the old focus cabin was too small. There wasn't room to put the 13-beam multi-beam receiver in there. But with thanks to the failure of the Galileo antenna, we were able to extend man's knowledge of the universe even more. And so maybe we should need more missions like that. It's been really great for Parkes Observatory, for radio astronomers around the world who come to use a telescope.
So I noticed while we're actually in the control room doing the observations that it isn't actually operated like the Jodrell Bank Level Telescope, where we have a central controller or operator who is essentially there 24 hours of the day. Whereas at Parkes, there are several computers on a desk of which you can use the digital filter banks and the different software and the multi-beams. There's quite a lot of visitors who go to the Parkes Telescope to use it in different setups. So star formation people, pulsar people like myself, and other people with different interests. So out of curiosity, how much time is actually allocated to these different astronomical research areas?
Okay, well, it depends on the astronomers. We're a national facility. We're owned by the Commonwealth Government, operated as a national facility through the CSIRO, which means that any astronomer in Australia and around the world can apply to use it. Their projects are judged on their merits, and if we think the project is good enough, we will give them the time. We don't charge anyone for it. They just come along, use the facility and acknowledge us in the papers and so on. And currently about 50% of astronomers would be Australian and another 50% would be from overseas. And we treat the overseas astronomers as, you know, just as we do the Australians. Currently around 50 to 60% of the time the telescopes used for pulsar observations. About 10 or 15% would be for VLBI, very long baseline interferometry, where we link up the Parkes telescope with other radio telescopes around Australia and around the globe to simulate a larger telescope. And then the remainder would be for spectral line observations and other types of observations. But it does depend on the astronomers, what they submit and so on, and how important we think the research is, and we'll give them the time. We try, because there is a lot of competition, the telescopes operated around the clock. So when astronomers visit, they usually come in groups of two or more, and they work in shifts around the clock to get the most of their time.
So I've noticed while I've been around here that there's also a 12-meter dish, which is just further down from the Parkes telescope. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
So the surface area of the Parkes telescope is about 1 acre, or about 3,500 square metres. But the next generation radio telescope that the World Radio Astronomy Community wants to build will be one or two orders of magnitude more sensitive still. And in fact, what we want to build is a radio telescope that has a collecting area of 1,000,000 square meters or 1 square kilometer, equivalent to about 300 times the Parkes telescope surface area. So you can't possibly build a single dish that large. It's just impossible. So the idea is to build thousands of smaller antennas all linked together so that the combined surface area of all those antennas will be 1 square kilometer, 1,000,000 square meters. And a consortium of around 20 countries has come together to design and build this thing. And about 3 years ago, the Australia and South Africa were shortlisted as the two preferred sites of where the facility will be built. The final decision as to whether Australia or South Africa will be chosen won't be made until about 2012 or 2013. 2011 is when our Pathfinder instrument will be built. Our chosen site where we want to build the Square Kilometre Array is in the West Australian desert, about 300 or 400 kilometres northeast of the small town of Geraldton, which is on the coast of Western Australia. The entire shire, I think, has a population of 4, and that's over thousands and thousands of square kilometres of arid land. It's just, it really is the middle of nowhere, which is what you want when you want to build something that is incredibly sensitive, like the Square Kilometre Array. And so we think we've got the best site for it. But in order to strengthen our bid to host the facility, 2 years ago, the Australian federal government gave the CSIRO about $110 million to build a Pathfinder instrument there. And we're calling that the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder, or ASCAP. And ASCAP instrument will be 36 12-meter diameter antennas built at our preferred site for the SKA, and we hope to have that built by 2011, 2012 or so. The ASCAP is a smaller instrument. Those 12 antennas will have the equivalent collecting area of the Parkes telescope. And so the idea is, before we go ahead and do that, because we want to build some really innovative technologies and incorporated in that to really push the cliche, the envelope on the of the technology and the capabilities, we built here at Parkes a 12-meter testbed antenna about 500 meters east of the big telescope, where we would test those new innovative technologies early next year in Western Australia. And then very shortly after that, the other 35 antennas will be built around it. And the idea is that we'll have all those antennas and the ASCAP facility built in place, operating, doing great science, just in time for the decision as to where to build the SKA will be made to strengthen our bid. And if we don't get it, then we still have a great facility in Western Australia, and we'll work with the South Africans to build theirs. But the South Africans have a similar idea. They've built a Pathfinder instrument at their preferred site.
Called Meerkat, I think.
Meerkat, yeah. But it's using more conventional type technologies for that. But we want to be able to demonstrate that we can operate a telescope in a remote site, and astronomers won't be going out there to use it. They'll actually be sitting where, you know, at a science operations center, probably in Sydney or maybe Geraldton or even the other side of the world, you know, do everything over the internet. So I think we're still working on just how we're going to do the observations, but it is a very remote site. Things are looking pretty good, and the testbed antenna we have here is working well at the moment, and our engineers are being quite busy making sure that the new technologies will work, and we're very confident that they will.
Okay. Thank you very much, John.
Okay, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.